Ace Podcast.
Hey everybody, it's Sam and Jason. We thought we'd give you a little bit of a disclaimer before you start this episode. This is our first one experiencing like demons and all of that. And it's definitely a subject that is plagued by a lot of controversy. You know, mental illness versus actual possession, all of that. But especially the content of this episode is some creepy stuff. It's gross in certain points. It's
quite graphic.
It's extremely graphic. If you have kids, I even say a swear word on this one.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, because I couldn't. There's no other way to describe
it. I can't listen to it
things.
Anymore.
Yeah. It's not one of the terrible ones, but.
Yeah, it's not like. Never mind. I'm not even going to go
yeah,
there.
Yeah, no, let's
so,
not.
Anyway.
So if you feel the need to not listen to this one, it is dealing with demon possession. It is scary. It is gross. It is disgusting. If you feel the need to not listen to this, don't even worry about it, guys. We love
cover
you.
Cover your ears.
Yeah, just don't cover your ears. Just turn it off.
Oh, I guess that works too.
It's not like my voice is going to reverberate ears. Through the home and they have to be there. Just turn off your podcast. It's fine. Go listen to something else. It's fine. There's a lot of podcasts out there.
But I mean, feel free to download it.
Yeah, please still download it. Anyway, guys, thank you so much. And yeah, just feel free, do whatever works. If for one last thing I'd like to say though, because we're dealing with some pretty delicate things, mental illness, abuse, all of that, we need your feedback. If we say something or do something that is not okay, if anything we say like hurts you or offends you or just doesn't sit well with you, please let us know. We need to grow as people and as broadcasters.
And of course, we're not trying to offend you
of
in
course.
Any manner whatsoever. So I guess we'll see you on the flip side.
All right. Without further ado, The Exorcism of Anna Eklund.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone Podcast. I'm Jason Moitoso.
And I'm Sam Fredrickson.
Welcome to the show tonight. And today we do have a little bit darker conversation that we're having.
A little heavy.
Yeah, a little. Just a big weight on your chest.
Crushing.
I'm not talking about night paralysis this time.
There should be, if I edited this correctly, right before this started playing, there should have been a little disclaimer, and I would advise you, if you are spiritually inclined, if you do have issues with, you know, demons, we're not going to do anything to make it spookier than it already is. I don't even think I'm going to put in spooky backing music for
yeah,
this
one.
Yeah,
to be honest, I think we're being rather standoffish with the spookiness, sorry.
Yeah. We're gonna do our best to just report the events, but the events are disturbing and unsettling. And so we just want to say, if you don't want to listen to this, don't listen to it.
You can just go straight to reviews. Give us 5 stars and tell us how great we are.
There we go. We are not going to be upset if you skip this one. And that applies for every episode. We know that not everything is everybody's, you know, bag. So anyway, all right, let's get on with the show. So Jason, would you like to formally introduce our subject?
Today we're talking about the possession of Anna Eklund. Eklund.
It's just Eklund.
Eklund.
Yeah.
So I was A-okay the first time around.
Yes, you were fine. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Perfect. Which is probably the most well-known possession in all of American history.
Yeah, well, and it's certainly the most well-documented, which is what makes it stand out. Multiple first-hand, second-hand accounts of it. You know, it's not all just, oh, my brother told me that one time he met a guy who said this and that. It's a fairly well-documented account. Anyway, before we get too far into that, you know, we're going to talk about all the heebies and the jeebies here in a minute. Jason.
Yes, Sam.
Tell me about exorcism in general. You know, its history, its purpose.
Okay, that's fair. So exorcism essentially goes back as far as culture does, as far as origin stories for most of mankind. You can find some form of exorcism and exorcist religiously on almost every culture throughout the world.
So I think a lot of people may think that exorcism is just primarily a...
Like
a
Catholic thing?
Catholic,
no,
Christian phenomenon.
Absolutely
so that's not.
Not
the case.
There, yeah, again, there are some forms of exorcists pretty much all throughout history. Exorcism takes place currently around the world and actually very prominent in third world countries, a lot of which we're seeing in a lot of the Muslim Middle Eastern countries, mm-hmm. and also quite a bit in Africa as well, which the Africa part surprised me quite a bit. Primarily, it is actually done to, for a lot of times, like kidnapped child soldiers.
Oh, wow.
Are usually put through an extreme experience when they get kidnapped.
Yeah,
a lot of
yeah.
them, you know, like killing yeah. your own parents and stuff like that. So a lot of heavy trauma mentally that occurs to them and leads to mental health issues mm-hmm. that are not treated to the best of
right.
what our modern ability is.
Right. Well,
and a lot of these countries are very tied to their religious backgrounds and their beliefs, and they don't have as much training in mental health. A lot of times we'll have exorcists come in and try to deal with these, thinking that they are some form of demon uh-huh. or possession, when really it's just some of us that don't get the medical help that we really need and the attention that we need. We're also seeing very similar kind of systems popping up in, again, the Middle East, but in a lot of Muslim communities. And again, mm-hmm. This is not exorcisms are not just a Christian thing. It's
yeah,
not
it's worldwide.
Yeah, many cultures, many religions believe in possession. And I mean, heck, I'm even we talk about it even without being like religiously, like we're dealing with our demons.
Right.
Like
yeah.
that kind
it's
of
a
saying.
It's
in our modern language, even though we're not referring to the fact that we actually are possessed by demons.
Right.
You know, it's again a way to identify the inner struggles that
yeah.
we're dealing with.
Well, and what I found interesting, especially because you were talking to me about it before, I didn't do any research for myself on, like, this, you know, exorcism at large. I just focused on Anna.
This story.
And it was interesting to me how it seems like, in a lot of cases, exorcism takes the place of what is needed being therapy, essentially.
Yes.
Mental health.
Exactly.
Practices. And we want to make it fairly clear, there are two main reasons that I really didn't want to do this episode. The first being that because of my life, my experiences, and my beliefs, I do believe in literal demon possession, and I do believe that it's like, it's just something you really shouldn't talk about and mess around with. That's why the Ouija board, I'm never going to get in the same room as a Ouija board, in the same house if I can help.
I mean, I might get in the same room. Aren't they sold at like Target?
That's true. Yeah,
Hasbro make them?
Little Pony Ouija board. That's the first one. But the second one is because tragically there are a lot of deaths and a lot of essentially abuse that comes about in the name of exorcism.
Yeah, I mean, one of the studies I found was claiming that over 370,000 deaths are attributed to
wow.
exorcisms, and another 300,000 injuries.
Yeah.
Were attributed to it, and that's just the ones that we have in recording. I'm sure,
right? Oh, I'm
plenty
sure
go hushed as well, mm-hmm. Which is just downright unfortunate.
Yeah, well, and that's the reason that we're doing this subject, this specific exorcism. Not only is it one of the most well known, the most well documented, it's also one of the most overtly supernatural. Well, thank you, Jason, for that.
Yeah, man, I learned a lot, unfortunately. And it's weird yeah. because when you Google, because that's how I started searching, just like possession versus mental health, a lot of things that you find are heavily weighted on the possession side.
Uh-huh.
And there's not a ton, as far as that I could really find, that really have a scientific look into the two differences.
Right.
So there's no like national study done
right.
on, you know, the differences between what is a mental health case and what is demonic possession.
Right. We don't believe that every case of possession is a legitimate possession, but we also don't believe that every case of it is just mental illness. With Anna, there's a good chance that it was both. The primary source for this episode is a booklet that's entitled Begone Satan. Now, it was written by a Father Karl Vogel back in 1935, which is about 7 years after the events of Anna's exorcism. The information, the facts presented in the booklet are verified by three different sources, being the two priests who participated, as well as one of the priest's housekeepers who was present for a good amount of the events. Now, the document is in the public domain. We are going to link to it in the show notes. We're going to try to cover as much of it as we can, but it's very thick, very dense.
Did you ever see like an actual physical picture of the book?
No, I didn't.
Because every time you say booklet, I think of like one of those little brochure pamphlets.
That's essentially what it was. What it was a, do you know what a tract is? A gospel tract, a Bible tract. Basically, in the modern day, they've become even more elaborate, but...
Is it like a little booklet that you hand out that just tells a story?
Yeah, it's essentially like a pamphlet. Cool. And that is what this was. This wasn't something that was written and publicized to, you know, make money or profit. This was written and distributed to members of the clergy, the Catholic Church. It wasn't some money-hungry grab or anything like that. It was an actual... so that they could train themselves better, essentially. Anna Eklund was born in 1882. Her mother's name has pretty much been lost to history, but her father was a man named Jacob. Now, her mother was assumed to have been a devout Catholic because Anna, in her early life, was just extremely pious, loved the church, loved Jesus Christ, and wanted to go to church, wanted to be involved, and really was just the model Catholic kid. She just loved every facet of it. However, her father, which we're going to get into here, but he was known as a drunk, he was a womanizer, he was just a villain in general. So it's believed that it was her mother who really gave her her piety. She, like I said, we don't have any accounts of her mother. We don't even know her name at this point. Anna lived a good childhood, essentially. She was your model Christian for the first 14 years of her life. However, around 14, there was a dramatic and drastic shift, and she began to show what, especially back then, were the telltale signs of demon possession. One of the telltale markers was that she found herself unable to participate in church activities and go to mass and the services. At first, she would attempt to enter the church building, but she would be blocked by some unseen force. I basically think of it just like, you know, she's walking.
She
hits an invisible wall. Yeah, that's essentially how it's described.
Yeah.
However, after just a few years, she began to just show an aversion to religious artifacts and imagery in general. She couldn't see a picture of the cross. She couldn't speak the name of saints or anything like that. And those are, you know, when you're looking for demon possession, that is usually where that sort of stuff starts. She also began describing what were referred to in multiple of these old accounts, these old first and secondary sources, were deprived and disturbing sexual acts that she like had an incline to carry out. It doesn't say what that was, and honestly, I don't want to know. It does state at the end of the booklet that she didn't actually participate in any of these. These were just urges that were overwhelming her. She described voices from within herself that would encourage her to rebel against the church, and she also started to get violent, essentially. She reported that when priests would come to try to console her, that she would get the urge to throttle them. She wanted to strangle them, and she would break religious artifacts that were put in front of her. Now, one other interesting element, even though, you know, back in the 1920s, it was, or back in the, this would be the early 1900s, it was definitely not like an enlightened period of understanding regarding mental illness. But one interesting element is that Anna Eklund, her story did not immediately jump to demon possession. And the thing to note, especially in the Catholic Church, is that you don't just have rogue priests going around performing exorcisms left and right. Like, these things have to be sanctioned. They have to build a case, they have to present their case to their bishop, and then the bishop has to sign off on it and says okay. So as a part of all of that, of course, she went to see doctors. They all the people who took her, it doesn't even say. I would assume it's the priests, because her father definitely couldn't care less. But the priests described what she was doing and exhibiting as hopefully just signs of nervousness, signs of anxiety, hysteria. Maybe it's just hallucinations. And every doctor that she went to, which were the leading doctors in her field, or in their field.
I mean, that being said, this is also like the 30s.
Right. So, well, no, this is the 1902, 1903. Okay, so, yeah,
turn of the century then.
Yeah. Like I said, it's definitely not like a renaissance for mental illness.
Yeah, it's absolutely not. It's definitely nothing similar to what we have now. I mean,
no.
Back in, like, what, the 40s? Yeah. We thought smoking was a great way to lose weight.
Yeah.
Which, I mean,
it is. I'm fatter now than I ever was before.
There's also, like, I'm just saying, like, our systems have gotten a lot better. Of course, they're still not perfect.
No,
especially not
course.
In mental health. I think that's probably grown the most.
The most, but it still has so much
20,
to
30
go.
Years. Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. We definitely have not handled mental illness nearly as well as what we could.
No.
And this is probably, again, one of the latest advancements in our medical fields is mental health.
Yeah. They took her to see these doctors. The doctors all said, no, she's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with her at all. It's just, they didn't even say it's just this or that. You know, they just said that she's a completely normal person. This was when it started to be like, okay, we need to step in. We need to do something about this. The church is planning an exorcism. It was said that by the time she was 26 years old in 1908, she was completely and totally possessed. And her first exorcism was actually performed on June 18th, 1912, by a monk of the Capuchin order named Father Theophilus Reisinger. We're going to say Reisinger.
That is a name.
Yeah. Father Theophilus Reisinger from Wisconsin. By all accounts, it was a successful exorcism. The demons left and all of that. But the booklet, as well as all the other sources I found, cite a verse in the Bible. This verse is, it's Matthew 12, verses 43 through 45. And essentially, I'm going to read it here in a second, but essentially what it means is that if a demon's expelled and the possessed is not properly safeguarded against further possession, that the demon's going to return, and it's going to return sevenfold worse than what it was. So that's what this verse states. It says, when the unclean spirit has gone out of a person, it passes through waterless places seeking rest, but finds none. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds the house empty, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and brings with it seven other spirits more evil than itself, and they enter and dwell there, and the last state of that person is worse than the first. And this does seem to be, by all accounts, what did happen with Anna. After a brief respite of peace and calm and happiness, her state worsened drastically, and she found herself tormented night and day. These urges, the same sort of ones she had earlier of, you know, kill the priest, break the cross, you know, destroy this religious imagery and these relics, suddenly they were also being turned at her. And it was just night and day. She was being told time and time again that she essentially just needs to commit suicide. That's the only way she's ever going to be happy. And that's where, for me, we tread like too close to home, I guess. We hit too close to the mental illness part of it. None of what we've said already is why we're doing this show, because everything we've said could simply be unfortunate mental illness. You know, for a 14-year-old to begin having sexual urges or to violently outburst it at members of authority, for tragically, you know, someone of any age to feel harassed by their inner voices, inner demons telling them to hurt themselves or anything like that.
Yeah, and I honestly still think a lot of this story, if not all of it, can still be linked to mental health, even after reading most of it.
All right.
And of course, I'll go over why later.
Yeah, we'll get through it. This is, like, these sorts of things are the entire reason why we didn't necessarily want to do this. Like, hey guys, what do you want to learn about next? And you wonderful, beautiful listeners who I love so much, we're like, demon possession. So that's where we are.
All right.
That's where we are now. But all of these things coalesced. It wasn't just overnight. you know, this went on for years and years and years until it finally led to her final exorcism, which was performed in 1927 between August and December of that year.
Ooh-wee.
Yeah, it was like a 16, 17-week period. Taken together, all in total, it was 23 straight days, but they were broken into three sections of a little over a week each.
So 23 days of pure exorcism.
Of pure exorcism, yeah. The rest of it was just rest, recuperation, monitoring her to make sure that, you know, she didn't hurt herself or anyone else around her. And it took place in a convent of Franciscan nuns in Earling, Iowa. The booklet, Begone Satan, begins its narrative with the meeting of a reverend by the name of Joseph Steger and, oddly enough, that same Father Theophilus Risinger, the Capuchin monk who originally exorcized Eklund decades earlier.
I'm
Now,
just going to refer to him as Father Theo.
yeah, that's pretty much how we're referring to him from here on out.
All right.
Now, it should be noted that both of these men's firsthand accounts were the source material for the book. They both affirmed the accounts within as being honestly and faithfully recorded. So keep that in note. Now, essentially, in this exchange, you learn that Father Theo has another case of demon possession that he needs to deal with in a discreet way. The woman in question, Anna Eklund, is located nearby, and in her hometown, she was making waves, essentially. People were like, oh, that Eklund, she's
She's
something's.
a topic for
Yeah,
conversation.
something's not right with her. And so they decide that they want to move her and bring her to this.
I can't imagine it was a large town.
Oh, no. It
No,
doesn't even
so.
say what her original town is. We know that the exorcism took place in Earling, Iowa. We assume that Anna was from another town in Iowa, but we don't know exactly where.
But it's pretty safe to say that gossip gets spread.
Yes, exactly. Now, this harkens back to what I said earlier about the church having rules and regulations. Essentially, because Earling was Steger's jurisdiction, Father Theo had to come to him and request permission to do it there. He couldn't just take her over, you know, and make it happen. He definitely wasn't keen on the idea, but he said, you know what, if it's for the good of this poor woman and if it's going to help the church further itself into the new world, like, so be it, we'll do it. So they decide that they're going to house the woman in a convent of nuns nearby, and Steger agrees to be a part of the exorcism as well. He's later counseled by a bishop who, like, it almost seems like this bishop's like, you really want to do this? You really, I don't know if you should do this. This sounds like a bad idea. And it's weird because you'd think that this bishop was like, yes, we have to rid the world of the devil. But he was like, this might not be the best idea, man. And he was like, nope, we got to do it. But to be fair, he wasn't doing it out of concern for like mental health or anything like that. He was doing it because he was worried that the devil was going to attack Steger for his involvement here. Now, Anna is moved to Earling by train. Again, because they're not really seeking a spotlight or anything, they're trying to avoid it. They try to keep it as secret as possible, but they do alert the authorities on the train just in case something weird goes down. The
It's so weird that it's taking place on a train.
I know. It's
So
like,
strange.
well, and I was sitting here and I was like, why would they do it on a train? Why would they move her by train? Why wouldn't they just get in their cars and go? And it's like, because it's 1928 in the rural area.
Yeah.
People don't have cars. So they transferred her to the convent, and then the business of the exorcism actually begun. Now, the very night that she was landed there, the supernatural aspects began to show themselves. One of the nuns, without any direction to do so, and in a totally different part of the convent, prepared Anna's food, and when she did, she sprinkled it with holy water and she blessed it. When she brought it in, Anna flipped out. She began hissing like a cat and she wouldn't touch the food. They said they were worried she was going to throw the plates and smash everything, so they switch it out. She claimed that the very presence of blessed objects like the food, like holy water, caused her body to feel like it was encased in hot coals. Now, as we've mentioned before, Anna was in the convent for a period of about 3 months. Out of those 3 months, only 23 of the days were spent in full-fledged exorcism mode. We know that a lot of people, when they're listening to this, they're listening for the details, for the weird
They want a
spookiness,
demonic
heebie-jeebie.
possession.
They want a demonic possession. So that's what we're going to give you. We're just going to go right into it. We're going to abandon the timeline.
Oh, boy.
But just keep in mind that between these events, there are usually hours, if not days, if not weeks, between these different instances. And especially when we get into the conversation with the demons, they would basically say one sentence and then howl for a few hours and then say another sentence. But we kind of just trim that all down.
My goodness.
So the exorcism begins with the securing of Anna to a mattress that was resting on an iron bed frame. She was bound in order to prevent the demons or herself from doing harm to herself or those around her. Like we previously stated, she had had very strong violent urges towards members of the clergy as well as towards herself. Now, Anna, it seems, had very many moments of lucidity. Like we said, only 23 of those days in those 16 weeks were in the exorcism mode. Whenever she was in exorcism mode, she didn't talk. She closed her eyes. Her mouth stayed closed. She didn't interact at all. For all accounts and purposes, she was entirely unconscious. And then all of this weird stuff would go down. But in between, she would wake up essentially and say like what happened, and she would confirm or deny things that came out during the exorcism process. Almost immediately, as Father Theo was saying a sort of introductory prayer, the real action started. Anna was thrown into the air. She had been lying flat, and suddenly her body was propelled through the air with lightning speed, and it slammed against the opposing wall. She was levitating. They grab her by the ankles, and they essentially rip her from the wall and then bind her again on the bed. Right after that, as the prayers continued, suddenly the howling started, and this howling, by all accounts, was consistent throughout the entire exorcism process. They mentioned it. They called it like a herd of beasts, wild, angry beasts coming from Anna's direction, Anna's body. Again, her mouth isn't open during any of this, but the sound still seemed to be coming out of her. It reverberated so much that it shook the room, and there were actually people, like, remember, the entire reason they brought her to the convent is because they're like, oh, we don't want people to know this is going on. We want it to happen in secret. But pretty much the entire town hears this, and they come to the convent, and they're like, what's going on? Is someone getting murdered? What do we have to do? Like, what's going on? And everyone was like, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine, don't worry about it. But then, of course, the word got out. And essentially, when people learned that there was an exorcism taking place, and especially a noisy one like this, some people, like, straight up moved and just, like, left the town until it was over. Some left and never came back. Yeah. Now, another strange and supernatural occurrence that happened throughout was the distortion of her body. And this is one of those ones where it's like, okay, what the heck? What the heck is going on here? Basically, parts of her would swell, and her head was described as being the size and shape of an inverted water pitcher. Parts of her,
what,
like,
what does that even look like?
Well, you know, like a pitcher, okay?
Yeah.
And it's got the rounded base, and then it goes up to the opening. So it was like that. So it wasn't just...
But it's inverted.
Yeah, so just upside down. Yeah, so it's not just like, oh, she, you know, her head got swollen. People's heads swell. Her head distorted, like elongated. Now, the same thing would happen with her lips and her arms. And they said that her lips, one of her lips would be the size of a grown man's hand, essentially. A lot of them were worried, like, it's kind of funny to think of. Well, it's not funny. It's actually really gross to think of. But a lot of them were worried
that she'd pop.
She'd just pop. Yeah. She would just explode because her body was not doing anything that a normal, natural body should be able to do. Other times, though, she would expand, her stomach would expand, and then it would contract to a smaller size, and it would be, like, hard as a rock. And then she would get heavy, like, dense, and the iron of the bed would actually bow and shift underneath her. Now, this part's a little gross, so fair warning, but we need to tell the story as best as we can. Because Anna was unconscious, they were actually forced to force feed her, essentially. They would try to give her milk or water, whatever her body would accept, However, they usually weren't able to do more than about a teaspoon at a time. Here's the gross part. Essentially, what would happen is during the exorcisms, she would begin vomiting. Even though she had only eaten a lot of times just one or two tablespoons or teaspoons of milk or water, she was vomiting literal bucket loads. And this would happen up to 20 times a day during the midst of the exorcism. These things were aimed at the priests, trying to defile their garments, trying to defile the crosses that they wore, the bits of consecrated host that they carried with them. Now, the consecrated host, for anyone who doesn't know, is the bit of holy sacrament that's taken at communion, and Catholics believe in a literal transubstantiation of the sacramental offering.
So, hey, good job.
Yeah, thank you. So essentially, they believe that the bread and wine used become the physical body and blood of Jesus Christ, and therefore to have these pieces of host attacked and desecrated was essentially like spitting or vomiting onto the body of Jesus himself. And in the old days, they killed people for that. You know, this was pretty typical demon behavior.
Feel this. They kill people for just looking at you weird.
That's true. Now, the howling and roaring happened every day for hours on end. Sometimes it would seem like a human scream. Sometimes it would seem like a pride of lions or barking of a group of dogs. But shortly after the exorcism was started, communication was established with the demons who were possessing her.
And this is when things get interesting.
This is when things get weird. And, very strange. Now, it was clear that some of these demons were actual devils, you know, fallen angels who fought against God. Other ones were simply deceased humans. They described the demons as speaking in a distorted, bestial way, whereas the voices that came out of her when a deceased human was speaking was simply the voice of another human. Now, the first entity that they made contact with was Lucifer himself. He boasted that he was not the only devil possessing her, and that there were hosts of others. Unidentified, more bestial, demonic voices would flow out of her, just babbling. Each one was distinct, and according to the priests, they were innumerable. There we go. The first recorded extended conversation, is between the exorcist, Father Theo, and a devil known as Beelzebub. A lot of people conflate Beelzebub with Satan and think that they're one and the same, but
he's just a prince of hell.
Right. Well, technically, Satan's a prince of hell as well.
But Satan's the prince of hell.
The number one dude. Technically, I don't want to say that. You're not the number one dude, Satan.
I mean, in hell...
That's true. He's the big guy there. Now, in all, I believe they're called daemonopedias, which are or basically encyclopedias of demonic possession or demons. Beelzebub is known as one of the seven princes of hell, but he is separate from Satan himself. Now, the demons associated as these princes are usually tied to one of the seven deadly sins. Beelzebub himself corresponded with gluttony. He was a winged demon who is known as the Lord of the Flies and is said to be the source of the Canaanite god Baal. And Baal or Baal was an Old Testament god worshipped by the Canaanites, who was pretty consistently referred to as like an antagonist to the Hebrew god. He's referenced also in the first century CE work, The Testament of Solomon, as well as by Jesus Christ himself in the New Testament. In more modern times, like I said, Beelzebub has been confused with being Satan himself, but he's definitely a distinct entity when we look back through the ages. His title, Lord of the Flies, is meant to be a derogatory one, basically because, you know, what's the Lord of the Flies? This is the poop that they eat. They eat poop, and therefore Beelzebub is poop. Yep. And it compared his followers to flies. There have been associations with Beelzebub's possessions and literal flies. Yeah. There would be swarms of flies that just appeared. Other accounts of possessions regarding him, the possessed will actually vomit swarms of flies. Accounts of Anna's possession do refer to flies that just appear out of nowhere. However, I wasn't actually able to find that in the source material. And let's be honest, flies get inside. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. The conversation with Beelzebub is mostly unproductive. It's kind of a snapshot of a theological and demonological debate regarding the possibility of fallen angels atoning for their sins as well as the power of structure of hell. But what's important is that Beelzebub confirms that he was sent by Satan to possess Anna and has been possessing her since her 14th year. During the exchange, Father Theo spoke in English, German, and Latin, and the demon responded in the correct language without missing a beat. One other important fact that comes into light is that the demon was first sent into her by Lucifer at the request of her father, Jacob, who we're going to talk a little bit more in at, but he is a real...
What a D-bag.
Piece of crap. Yeah. Yeah, if we weren't striving for a safe-for-work rating, I'd have a lot to say about him. But Beelzebub would also mock Father Theo if he mispronounced a word or misspoke. And finally, Theo asks why Jacob cursed his own daughter, and Beelzebub essentially says, ask him yourself. So that's what they think is going to happen. They say, okay, bring him forward. And then another voice starts. And this is a human voice. It's completely different from Beelzebub. It just sounds like a man speaking. The next entity that introduced themselves, they thought it would be Jacob, but it was actually that of Judas Iscariot. And for, you know, the few of you out there who don't know, Judas was the disciple that betrayed Jesus Christ to the Romans for 30 pieces of silver. Shortly after that event, Judas committed suicide, most commonly told as him hanging himself in a desolate field, which essentially, because they never got to pay Judas, they used that money to buy the field and turned it into a graveyard for the body of suicide victims because they couldn't be buried in consecrated ground, according to the old belief. Because of this, Judas is sometimes referred to as the patron demon of suicide. Now, in Dante's Inferno, Judas is one of three beings, the other two being Brutus and Cassius, who betrayed Julius Caesar, who are condemned to be eternally devoured by Satan himself in lowest... So here's the thing, because Dante's Inferno was written by Dante, who was an Italian, a Roman, he obviously deified Julius Caesar.
Right.
Whereas, like, yeah, Caesar was definitely an amazing individual. He was also a tyrant.
Yeah, and, exactly.
Yeah, so, like, so it's like, okay, yeah, yeah, they probably don't deserve it. Judas, yeah, that's
I mean, I'm not gonna lie,
one, but
being stabbed over 50 times, that's a little rough.
It is a little rough, isn't it?
But, you know, you gotta get things done.
You gotta do what you gotta do, such is politics, you know? When the voice of Judas comes through, he immediately begins just spitting and vomiting and trying to get that the consecrated host held by the priests to just be soaked in that. Upon questioning, Judas would explain that he had been included in the demonic caravan to try to cause Anna to kill herself. And it was this voice that had been urging her to do so since her 14th year. And he says some really problematic crap about suicide in general that we're going to touch on here, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we believe in it or support this interpretation at all. Essentially,
no, I don't quite understand. I'm sorry. I'm going to
stop
right there.
Please.
Why are demons that are possessing someone, egging them on to commit suicide? I mean, they finally have a prime spot of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they just want to get it off? I mean, like, I get it.
Yeah.
Another soul in hell. Theoretically, demons are just, you know, self-serving. So why would they want their body to die?
Well, you have, and he kind of talks about, they talk about this because they also interrogate, in addition to the big four that we're doing now, they also interrogate a lot of lower level nameless demons. Essentially, the demons are cursed into a person by Satan himself. They have a mission, and the mission is cause this person to kill themselves. That's given to them by Lucifer, who, if they fail, is just going to torture them even worse. But if they succeed, hey, maybe they get to get out of hell again for a little while. Maybe he doesn't, you know, hurt them so bad the next time around. And then with the chief lieutenants, like Beelzebub, like Judas, not technically a lieutenant or a prince of hell, but still up there on the hierarchy, it's because that they, you're right, they do have a body, but then as soon as this one's gone, they can go to a next one. You know, they don't, those ones don't really spend too much time.
It's more like Airbnbs.
Hell. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you for that. That's terrible.
I mean, yeah, always treat your Airbnb well. I mean, of course, okay. You want to get good ratings.
Don't vomit on it.
Please don't.
Please. So that's the idea, is that they would just body hop, And you know, they're trying to get people to kill themselves because, yeah, another soul in hell, another person condemned. I mean, I could go on an entire theological ramble. I won't. I could, though.
Please don't.
So we're not really going to try to unpack what Judas said, which is essentially that people only kill themselves because demons tell them to kill themselves. Every suicide is linked to a demon possession is essentially what he's saying. Finally, they were able to get Jacob to come to the forefront of the proceedings. As with...
It feels like a trial.
It really does. And the way that they portray it, that's exactly how it is. Now, as with Judas, his voice was a human one, without distortions or the bestial quality of the demons. And this is where we get to the core of the matter. Now, as previously mentioned by Beelzebub, Jacob had cursed the demons into Anna, but they weren't sure why. They're like, this is your dad. Why would your dad do that? And the ensuing conversation revealed not only the purpose and the reasoning, but it also just described or made you really realize that Jacob is... And I'm sorry here. I have to break our safe for work protocol, so plug yours. He's a real piece of shit. That's essentially what this comes down to.
Darn, I thought you were, like, gonna go...
No, I don't want to make it too bad, because we have younger listeners, but I can't describe him any other way.
He's a pretty screwed up individual.
Yeah. He did his best in life to be as brutal and debased and debaucherous as possible. On his deathbed, he was offered the sacrament of the extreme unction, which is, you know, your final last rites and all of that. And supposed to be like, okay, this is it. It's time to confess and repent, and you still got a chance. It's going to be good. And he just mocked the priest and died, basically. He admitted that on multiple occasions, he attempted to get Anna to participate in an incestuous relationship with him. She obviously refused, and that's the cause of the curse. He and his mistress, who was a woman named Mina, who was the village witch, essentially, and also Anna's aunt, but it doesn't clarify if it was his own sister or his dead wife's sister, they worked together to curse her. They'd use black magic on the spices and the food that she ate, and ingredients, in that food. They would invoke demons to possess her and open her up to torture, essentially. Even after death, he was still trying to torture her and get what he came for, essentially. He was just, yeah, that was his entire mission. All of his life and then all of his death was just to torture this poor girl. And that was the main root cause. Now, they essentially just tried to send him back to hell, but he ran away, retracted before he could be thrown out. And then after this, the mistress, Mina, was called forth. It was brought out that she was a witch. She killed her own children in life, four of them. She was much more hateful towards the priests and the church in general. Jacob just seemed to be like this anti-authoritarian dude who just wanted to do his own thing and be a disgusting, terrible human being. But Mina actively hated and rebelled against the Catholic Church and Jesus Christ. Together, they conspired to torture Anna, and even after death, made a deal with the devil to be able to come back and continue torturing her. Once Anna returned from the unconscious state she was in, they asked her, is this true? Did this happen? And she confirmed that, yes, this did happen. She doesn't elaborate on it, or she may have, but it's not elaborated within the text. Anything you want to say about all that, Jason?
Do you really want me to dive into it now?
Sure.
I think that it's clear and obvious signs of childhood abuse, which...
Of course, yeah.
...is absolutely a firm identifier for most mental health...
Mm-hmm. Issues.
Issues, yeah. So I think that plays a huge role.
Yeah.
And I truly think that's really what the case was, even with everything else that's been going on. I'll dive into that later, but also I could see how... I'm not saying Jacob's a good guy.
No.
I'm sure he's, you know, a twisted individual... At least he was, but I could definitely see how, especially in a smaller town, smaller community, how gossip can twist things around as well. And I don't know necessarily what occurred with his mistress's children and things like that. But
well, and to be fair, that's one of the unconfirmed parts of the story. That's the lore that it may or may not have happened. So that specific
part. Gossip gets around. I mean, even if she was, you know, not the nicest of people... either in that community, people starts talking in again, we're talking early 1900s.
Yeah.
A little bit rougher scene.
Yeah.
A little bit rougher if you're not essentially following the crowd. That, and it sounds better having these two wickedly evil people.
Right.
As far as the story goes. And that's one of my biggest issues with it so far, is the fact that there's a lot compounding on itself to where it makes it increasingly difficult to believe in, at least for myself.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I still don't see the reason why Satan and, you know, a prince of hell would care about embodying and possessing a girl from Iowa.
Right.
Again, it wouldn't be my number one choice if I was the prince of hell.
If I was doing it,
You know, and it's... Anyway, I'm gonna save the rest for later.
Yeah, totally. I just wanted to see how you were feeling
so far. Just gonna wrap it up, throw it in the fridge, save it for later.
You've been a little quiet.
That's fine.
You've been over here shaking your head and sighing. And so
I have been. Especially because, it's an older story, and I think that most, and a lot of times, because this is a pamphlet that's handed out to other priests, correct?
Correct.
And I'm almost positive I've brought it up before. Gothic cathedrals, the doors and the doorways are designed to scare people into their doors.
Right, right.
You have to have this extent of a story to get people to believe a lot of times.
I hear what you're saying there, but...
So I can see a lot of... fabrication in some of this.
Right. But if you're distributing this to members of the clergy and the priests, they're already believers, essentially.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get it. We'll dig into that here in a minute, I promise.
Okay.
But...
go ahead and continue our story.
Well, then. And I'm glad you said that, because that is where we transition.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, apart from the body swelling, apart from the supposed levitation and all of that, it could all just be, I mean, not to belittle anything, it could be a throwing of the voice, essentially. You know, her mouth seemed closed, but she could have still been, had it open and throwing the voice.
You mean
to
like
make
a
it
ventriloquist?
Sound. Right, yeah.
What? They can do that?
Yeah.
I thought it was the puppet the whole
time. Okay, all right. So it could be all pretty scientifically explained at this point, and that's fine. That's good. This next part is I'm just going to run through essentially some of the more unexplainable to me supernatural aspects of the case. And these are from the source material. These are confirmed by 2 to 3 people each. So keep that in mind. The first thing that's weird is that the demons were able to sense the presence of a holy object specifically. You can assume that a priest is going to have a holy object on them. That's just how exorcism and priests work. However, for one, Steger had a small religious relic that was related to a Saint Therese who was called the Little Flower of the Child Jesus. He kept it on his person, unbeknownst to anyone else in the room. However, the moment that he walked into the room with it in his pocket, the demon called it out, told him to get rid of it. He said, essentially, away with that little flower, away, away. It's that specific, I know exactly what you have in your pocket, essentially. The other thing is the demon's mastery of language. In one experiment, a piece of paper bearing an inscription in Latin believed to be a sacred prayer by everyone in the room, but really just a passage of literature, was placed on the possessed's forehead. Even the nuns in the room thought that it was real and authentic, and they were surprised that it invoked no response. However, when it was switched for an authentic prayer, Anna howled, and the prayer, without being touched, tore itself into 1,000 pieces. When it was Lucifer possessing Anna, he gave bizarrely specific information regarding the crucifixion of Christ, like as in how his feet were nailed to the cross. He said that first it was the left foot and then the right foot on top of it. Strangely enough, this description matches exactly one given by an obscure Catholic mystic named Anne Catherine Emmerich decades earlier. And Emmerich was said to have had visions of Christ on the cross. Her writings were extremely obscure. Like, it wasn't like you could go to the bookstore and find this and that's where Anna found it. It's still possible that she knew of this and was using that information. However, and even within the booklet, the author states that this obviously isn't concrete proof, as no one who saw the crucifixion is alive today. At another point, Satan actually threatened Reverend Steger. He specifically stated he would take his revenge on Friday of that week. When Friday came, the Reverend was in a near-fatal car accident. He had essentially been driving across a bridge when the car shifted and lurched into a railing on the bridge, almost breaking through and going over into the ravine below. It should be noted as well, especially when it was Satan doing the possessing, that the nuns and the priests would be mocked and riled up kind of by repeating sins that had been committed when they were younger. And it falls in line with the Catholic belief in absolution, which is that Satan cannot, and Satan admits that he cannot see the sins that they've confessed. Absolution essentially means that once you've confessed it and repented, honestly, it's gone. It's like it never happened at all in the eyes of God and also the demons. And so they would. They'd go and before exorcisms, it was common to have hour-long confessions, the priests confessing to their bishops in order to not let the devil have leverage. But all of these sins were pretty much forgotten. Like, the people who committed them didn't even remember doing it necessarily until it was referenced, because it was all back when they were kids. Now, the last really weird thing is that Seeger's home, who he had lived there for 12 years previous, was infested with rats the night that the exorcism began. He had never had a rat problem in the past. Now, near the end of the final exorcism, Father Theo decides to continue without ceasing for 3 straight days and nights. He's said to be the image of a walking corpse by the end of it. He finally got it out that the devils were still there because there had not been sufficient atonement made for the young woman. They responded by packing Reverend Steger's church and having every one of their parishioners pray fervently for Anna. Now, at this time, Anna began describing seeing horrible battles between good spirits and evil spirits, angels and demons, and that the demons seemed endless and never ceasing. However, during this marathon exorcism that Father Theo was doing, some of the nuns would look up and they'd see blooms of white roses sprouting from above the ceiling and took it as a good omen. Finally, on the 23rd day, the devils began to give up. They realized that the nuns and pastors were not going to give up. They weren't going to let Anna kill herself or be killed by them. And they were simply just tired of fighting. They said, okay, it's a lost cause. We're going to move on to the next one. At 9 p.m. on December 23rd, 1928, Anna was lifted into the air, levitating above the bed, standing up straight. Theo blessed her with the relic of the cross and commanded the demons to depart. He demanded that as they left, because there was such a host of demons within her, that they would call out their names as a sign-off when they left, so that he knew for sure that they were gone. Suddenly, the room shook with thunderous noise. The names Beelzebub, Judas, Jacob, Mina were proclaimed, and then a second time they were said again, but then the word hell was added after every name. So Beelzebub, hell, Judas, hell, Jacob, hell, Mina, hell. This was in accordance with that demand made by Father Theo. And for the first time in the last, I think it was seven days since the final exorcism began, Anna opened her eyes and said, oh, from what a terrible burden have I been freed at last. My Jesus, mercy, praised be Jesus Christ. And this was the first time she had spoken Jesus' name in over 12 years, but the demons left one parting gift, which was an unholy and unbearable stench that filled the room for days. A few days later, she received communion, and by all accounts, she lived a relatively normal life. There were talk of later minor possessions of Anna, but they could essentially be cured just by her taking communion and purging it that way. The booklet ends with the testimony of Teresa Wegner, the housekeeper of Father Stiegler, who claimed that all these things were correct. She also, it's interesting because she also names people who interacted with Anna and mentioned that all the nuns were transferred a year later due to not being able to stay in that convent because of the memories made there, which is interesting. You could essentially, back in 1935, go to these people that she named and said, hey, did this happen? You know, is this real? And in theory, they would have said, yeah, that happened, or we saw this, or we did that. The story also references, as like one last piece of sort of collaborating evidence, it also references a woman named Teresa Newman. She was extremely strange. I don't know that we're going to do a show on her. I don't think we are, but we might. Who knows? She was a visionary in Connersreith, Bavaria, in Germany.
Oh my gosh, dude. Bravo. I was waiting on that.
Boom. I probably mispronounced it, but at least I said it with authority.
It was confidence. That's what sold it for me. How many times did you practice that in the mirror?
None. I never practice these pronunciations, as is evident by Steiger and Steiger and Risinger and Risinger.
Steiger?
Steiger? Bipedal?
Bipedal, I mean.
Yeah.
It's got two pedals.
Right?
That's how I walk on my pedals.
We're so close. She claimed to have had a vision of the same great battle that Anna had between the angels and demons at the same time, and confirmed the reality of the exorcism that had happened a year or an ocean away. Now, all told, the exorcism took 23 full days from dawn to dusk, and Anna's time in the convent lasted from mid-August to late December in total. Her case is one of the most famous in the world, pointed to again and again as a genuine account of possession. It's been written about at length, mentioned in every Daemonpedia in the world, and even adapted into a real crappy movie. It's got like 5% on Rotten Tomatoes.
See, I knew it was in a movie.
Yeah, that one came out like 2 years ago. But
it's
been everywhere, and it's done everything. So
it's been 3 weeks since you looked. It's been 3 weeks since I've thought about anything normal.
Right? I know. It's been 4 months since I've thought about anything.
That's fair.
Normal.
That is fair.
All right, man. I know you didn't talk.
I know.
Well, you
I
talked a lot, but
patiently.
By the time this is all edited, it's going to sound like you didn't talk at all.
Yeah, I know. It's because I got a whole lot out of me at first, and then I just let you do your little thing.
I appreciate it.
And I guess it's time for you to let me do my little thing.
Yeah, let me have it. Just talk.
Sam, would you like to know the differences that make separate a bad lie from a good lie?
The details?
Exactly!
Would you say that the devil's in the details?
Oh, absolutely, 110%. This is, I honestly think, just an incredibly good story to cement your faith. That if you are a priest, especially a priest like training on exorcism, a story like this would 110% make you feel concrete about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's wrong, and I'm not saying that it's a complete and utter lie, and I'm not saying that religion is silly. But what I'm saying is that you do have to look at some of these stories with an eye of scrutiny. And there are a lot of things that are over the top with it.
All right.
I also think you mentioned it, that Teresa Newman, no, it wasn't Teresa Newman. Teresa Wegener. Listed out the names of all the nuns that were there.
Uh-huh.
And you thought that was interesting, that you could go up to these nuns and ask whether they thought that was true or not. I thought it was interesting that they were all gone within a year.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to leave if this did happen.
Yeah.
But it also makes it really easy. Like, they got transferred. There's,
but they requested the transfer from accounts.
Sure, they requested the transfer. They might have. It's I think
you
that
gotta
a lot
believe
of this,
a little. You gotta.
I believe
you gotta
a little.
Try to give
told,
at least the benefit
Sam,
of the doubt.
Before we even recorded this, I told you that I believe a demonic possession could occur to some state or another, but I also think that 99.99999, all with an asterisk next to it, are just misguided attempts to cure mental illness. Now, that being said, prayer can absolutely help with curing mental illness. I think it what we really require is a melding of the two, in a sense.
Faith and medicine.
Yeah, especially when it comes to mental health. I definitely absolutely think that anyone that is performing these kind of acts should absolutely have some medical training in the mental health field as well, because there is probably a discerned difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what your faith is, there are definitely times where it absolutely is going to be mental illness over the fact that a demon is possessing you or a subject that you're there to help.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. It's
okay. All right.
It's a great story.
So you think it's just a story?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
That's a fair 110%. Assumption.
I think that she might have had some bouts of schizophrenia and dissociated personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was all linked because for most of her life, what she knew most of was scripture, was of her religion.
Right.
For her other personalities to take form as demons and devils makes a lot of sense. Especially for the turmoil that she was experiencing from her father in a young age.
Right.
There are plenty of ways to connect and associate those with one another. That, I think, it's a bit over the top as far as the story goes. I mean, for myself, it's to the point where all these little details are added in and all these, like, it wasn't just like a prince of hell. There was Satan himself in her.
Right.
That is, it's...
Well, and when
it's
look,
hard for
so,
me to say he has nothing better to do.
Right. So when you look at, which we didn't cover,
if he exists.
We went into a lot of this booklet. There's a lot more we didn't go into. And he talks about the reasoning behind it, which, again, take it as you will. It's basically a trial run for the Antichrist, essentially. That's why Satan's personally involved with this possession, and he's there, he's taking care of it because he's looking at getting the Antichrist all set up and ready to go. And again, this time they didn't put a date on it, which is good, because whenever you put a date on it, it doesn't
happen. It's
always
not true.
But they did like make reference to by the year 2000 the world would be a different, worse place. I think that's fair. I think that the world's probably not in the best state right now.
No, we have a lot going on.
We have a lot going on.
The world is much smaller than what it was in the 30s.
Right.
That's for sure.
But so that's like the reasoning on some of these big, like, why would Beelzebub be there? Why would Satan be there? But that's the reasoning. It could just be a justification, but...
I think it's more of a justification.
I understand.
I mean, that makes way more sense.
I understand.
That, and again, it solidifies the idea that if a priest is reading it, that it is, hey, this is, we're actively fighting the Antichrist
right.
as well. So, I mean, you can look at it on both sides.
Like a call to action.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So.
Speaking of a call to action, donate to our Patreon. Nope.
Oh, gosh.
Flagging
so,
that.
There you go. Those are my ideas and my theories, my criticisms of what we've covered here today.
Okay. They're all fair. They're all valid.
I just wish there was actually like a medical professional with them.
Right.
For most of this. That would help, of course, me out a great deal. One that wasn't associated with the faith.
Right. I mean...
Because I've read articles online by a doctor that is Catholic.
Right.
Just going to state that. That has been there for exorcisms as well.
Right.
And has aided in the determining whether which is what, which is interesting. He said that through about 25 years of doing it, he's never seen a levitation. While
which
other
is
exorcists,
one of those hallmarks.
One of the hallmarks that, like, because of modern, you know, pop culture, we assume that levitation's involved with every exorcism.
Right.
And it's just not the
case.
It's
not, no.
But that being said, he has spoken with others that have clearly stated that they have witnessed levitations as well.
Right.
And I mean, I don't want to completely undermine the legitimacy of any religious figure.
Right.
But I mean, if we're talking about speaking the truth and just the truth, not just what we believe in and what we perceive.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about a patron saint for a second.
Right.
He slayed a spider that was transformed into a woman and vice versa.
A woman that was
transformed
into
a spider
and then transformed back to a woman.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like one of those tragic things that you see where it's like, oh, it was a werewolf and then I killed it and then it was my father and then my father was dead. She was just fine.
Yeah. So
she turned out okay.
you know.
Yeah.
I think you should always look into... I think you should always do your own research on things.
Right, yeah.
Always,
point of the show. Yeah.
Always look into things yourself. And of course, 110%, make your own opinions on things. And that's really what we talk about. That's what we're here for.
Yeah. We're just here to guide you. We're just here to help you. You solid with it? You good?
I'm solid.
So, I mean, for me, your opinion is definitely a valid one.
Just the wrong one.
Yeah. I mean,
that's how I feel about the aliens,
and it's
too.
Because of a lot of things. It's because of my own spiritual background, my own, you know, belief system experiences. I agree with you on a whole lot of points. I think 99.99% is not misidentified. Or if it's not misidentified, it at least doesn't have to be as big and bad as it has been made. Yeah,
yeah.
Like, you don't have to be tying people down and essentially throwing water and all of that. You know, you can just do a more quiet, calm, persistent act instead of one big act, one explosion of faith. You can just have faith throughout that should ideally help.
Why did that have to force feed her if she's been eating normally outside of the sessions?
Because the sessions would last for 7 days at a time.
Dude, she has to be drinking a lot more water than
I know. No,
teaspoon.
I understand. But it is. It's things like, especially that.
It's not humanly possible to survive.
And what we conflate, and I think what your problem, let me tell you your problem.
What's my problem?
Yeah, well, your issue
is it
well
my anxiety?
It could be. Your issue as well as the issue of a lot of people. I mean, the fella had a great line. This is in the introduction to the booklet. For a time, it was fashionable to scoff at demonic possession as part and parcel of an outmoded superstition of bygone ages of ignorance, like the attitude of a lifetime ago in regard to the miracle of Lourdes, which is a different thing. But the facts are stubborn, also against the scoffing of so-called enlightened criticism. Stubborn facts cannot be denied even when they baffle all natural explanation. The absurd thing about such a position is that the critics just know, in quotes, that supernatural or preternatural phenomena simply, again in quotes, cannot be. So, to me, there's obviously an element of faith, not only in this specific case, of course, but in the paranormal in general. I have faith in the paranormal, and critics have faith against the paranormal. Basically, what it comes down to is we read these things and we say that's not humanly possible, that's not physically possible, and therefore it couldn't have happened because it doesn't fit with our understanding. Like our...
You mean the laws of physics?
Our understanding. You know, there's been a lot that we've covered here that, you know, both in this episode and throughout the show, and hopefully for the next many, many years that we do this, that don't fit with our understanding but do have, you know, some sort of evidence, some sort of trace evidence that something happened. And it's at that point where both, I mean, as a true believer, I am more than happy to open my mind to the possibility that I might be wrong. But I feel like, especially, not necessarily with you, but with critics in general, they will not open.
When he said you, he was gesturing with his hand towards me.
I was.
Okay.
Yes,
just clarifying for everyone.
And you, the listeners, as well. But with.
He just gestured toward his iPad for some reason.
That's where you all live, right? In this magic glass screen.
It's called technology, Sam. It's right? A thing.
Oh, now you derailed me.
Yes.
You critics, you, the listeners, you, the this and the that, and all the rest. Yeah, so, like, I can accept that I may be wrong, but I feel like the critics, the skeptics, will not even let that possibility into their heads. It doesn't need to be true or false or anything like that. It's the fact that the same faith that I have is the same faith that they have. It's just pointed in a different direction. You know, you cannot be, the universe is too big and unexplainable and mysterious to say
we're getting there.
that nothing could possibly, that this could not possibly happen. There's enough anomalous weird events that anything is possible. And so to dismiss something out of hand, especially like a heartbreaking account like this, which again, not the best example. There's a lot of evidence that it could be the other way. But things like the levitation, things like the unnatural excrement, things like the bed bowing and her mass changing.
Again, kind of like what we see just in pop culture for exorcisms.
Right, right. And it's in pop culture. It's kind of like what happened with the Beast of Gavudog.
Becomes stereotypical.
Yeah, he killed the beast with a silver bullet. And because of that, we have the fact that werewolves can be killed with a silver bullet. Not the other way around, you know. We see these things in this account, and then because of this account, they've made their way into pop culture.
Oh, yeah, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why I love doing this. I love seeing the origins of what we have in modern culture and the stories behind those.
Yeah.
It's fascinating just to sit here and talk about those kind of things.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, this can lead to one of them. That is one of these conversations.
Yeah. But I think that we could all do a lot better, myself included, to keep an open mind. Personally, on this case, I do think it was demon possession, if I take this at its word, which is something that I am pretty committed to do, unless something is like overtly just ridiculous. You know, I had mentioned before the problem with like reincarnation is that you get all these accounts of people being like, I was Alexander the Great. I was Pharaoh. I was Charlemagne. And no one's ever just like a farmer. Although there are a lot of accounts of just a farmer, just this or that. That sort of grandiose, like, I am great and the aliens chose me because I am the chosen one and all of that. I'm going to lead the world. That's the kind of stuff that turns me off and says, you're doing this for your ego.
But this story doesn't, even though the devil chose her.
The devil didn't choose her. Her father, quote unquote, chose her, unfortunately.
Right, but I mean, the devil's the one that listened to his pleas.
Right, but that gets into the fallacy of it could never happen because it's something rare that's a personal thing that could happen. The fact that it would happen to anyone means
it didn't
happen.
I'm just curious how
he
got the devil's ear.
I think trying to rape your daughter and perform black magic, that's a good way of getting the devil's attention.
All right.
I would say.
Okay, that's genuinely fair.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway, you know, with this case, that's what I believe if I take it at its word. It's not super grandiose. Like, the if you read it, it's a humble telling of, you know, you don't have the priest saying, I am the great demon slayer and all of this. In typical Catholic tradition, they give all the glory to God and all of that. But, and the saints, they do love their saints. But, you know, at the end of the day,
our saints, so I get it.
That's true. Sean, it could just be propaganda, but for me, I don't know. There's something more to it, but who knows?
Again, man, the Catholic Church has been using fear for quite a long time.
Right, that's true, but anyway, all right.
No offense to any Catholics.
No,
we
truly love
not.
Catholic
I'm just saying.
Fans, yeah.
Historically speaking, it wouldn't be the first.
Yeah. That's fine. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're 2 hours and 15 minutes in.
That's it? It's two?
My poor
God,
poor
I feel like
patrons.
We've been here forever.
All right, we're going to move forward here. We're going to keep going. We're almost there, and then I'm going to freaking edit this, and it's going to be great. So,
I hope so.
Guys, we had a great week for reviews. Thank you to everyone who reviewed. I'm going to call out everybody here in a moment. But we also had, once a month, I think it's like the 15th or the 17th, we get our international reviews in, and we're actually going to read one of those today because I really like it. And this is from, I believe it's Sam H. It's @MH from the UK. And Sam says, I couldn't sleep the other night. I'd listened to this show as I was getting ready for bed, and as I lay there in the dark alone, I was so thoroughly creeped out by the story of the Beast of Gavudon, I was awake until 4 a.m., Now, bear in mind that I am not a squeamish person, so I'd consider that to be a measurement of how well-crafted and presented the story was. Consider me a fan. Thank you, Sam, because that's my favorite episode,
and
too.
If your name is Sam, or S at M, H, wherever that might be, let us know how our British impressions were.
Oh, please don't.
Give us some pointers.
Remember that we're cutting that out of the normal.
We're probably going to be cutting this out too. There you go.
No, I think I'm going to leave it in. Ooh. For anyone interested, we'll get to Patreon here in a minute, but for anyone interested, there's a good 10-minute ramble at the beginning of this episode where we try out some accents, and it's terrible.
Well,
it's really bad.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
So we're going to call out, we're going to say big thanks to all of our international reviews. Sam H. from the UK, Solway84 from the UK. This one that I have no idea who this could be, but Fairy Tales for Unwanted Children from Canada.
Who's that?
I love you, Scott. Kirk Knowles from the UK.
Don't tell Katie.
Katie doesn't listen to the show. It scares her too much. I don't blame her.
That's fair.
XO Chill 66 from the UK and Jody Australia from Australia. I'm pretty sure I know what Jody that is. And Jody, you're fantastic. And then thanks to all of our at home listeners as well, we have Ajaz Janet, M. Joe Alexson, Double Nope, Charaded K, J. Ham, and now we have an elephant in the room. If you follow us on social media, you'll know that we actually received our first less than 5-star review this week. It was 2 stars.
Can we read it, please?
Yeah,
we should.
I will. I will read it because here's the thing. I've been around podcasting enough, and none of the podcasts that I admire and try to emulate do this, but I've been around podcasting long enough to have heard a lot of people like get a negative review and then they either try to hide it or they bash it or they say, oh, what an idiot. We're not going to do that because every week I come on this show and I say, I would love to hear what you think about the show. Literally any time I mention it online, I'd say, I'd love for your feedback. I'd love to hear what you think. And even if it's not like the
spectacular,
wonderful, we still value your feedback.
We should talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to read our first ever less than 2-star review. I'm going to point this out.
Less than 2-star?
Sorry, less than 5-star review.
Wow, that's not, you know.
Well, what I'd like to point out, I'm gonna brag on my listeners
a
little bit.
We got a 5-star review.
I'm gonna brag on my listeners a little bit. We've been at this for 4 months. We had 46 5-star reviews in a row before we got one non-5-star review. So
wow.
Thank you guys. You're all amazing. And this review here, which is titled Please Use Proper English by a fellow named Foggy Star, he says one guy sounds like he needs to blow his nose and the other guy needs to learn proper English. They talk over each other constantly, which that is fair.
Yeah,
that last part
that
is fair.
Yeah,
we do. He caps it by saying, this was recommended through another podcast. What a mistake. So,
all right.
There's that. I'm down with it. I'm good
challenge
with it. And
accept
you know
it,
what,
Foggy?
Yeah, Foggy, if you're listening, I don't know that you
probably
are.
Probably not.
But if you are, thank you for your feedback.
And I'll
we
keep
appreciate
that in mind.
It. And guys, I'm serious. We value any and all feedback. We're currently sitting at 48 iTunes reviews. My goal is to get to 50 by July. So if you haven't reviewed the show yet, maybe think about doing that. It helps us a lot. And then we have 2 new patrons.
Oh my gosh.
2 of them. All right. So the first one is from the Netherlands, I believe.
Okay.
I believe this is...
You're doing a lot of head nodding through this.
I believe that this is his name, and if you're listening, my good friend, and I mispronounced it, please let me know, and I will say it again next week. I believe it's simply Martin. So it's spelled a little differently from the Martin that I know, but I think it's just Martin. So
that's what I would say.
No, I wrote Martin in the notes.
Okay. That's Martin.
Yeah, so Martin, if that is your name, if I said it incorrectly, please let me know. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing everything right. But yay, Martin! Yay, thank you, Martin. And then we also have our good friend Rob Christofferson, who we mentioned last week about his podcast, The Turnbuckle Binge and the Maddie in Progress. He had a great interview on the Mad Scientist podcast, and he's just an all-around great dude. Like, I just like this individual. So, Rob! Thank you, Rob. Guys, one last piece of business. Well, 2 last pieces of business. 1, we got t-shirts. They're out.
We do?
Yeah, they're available to order. We'll put a link in.
Dude, where can I get mine?
You can go to
You like what
not
I did there?
I did. notalonepodcast.com/shop. And you'll see it. It's technically a pre-order. We're going to take pre-orders until we have... We originally said 50, but we might go down to 25. we're just going to take some pre-orders until we get that, or until the end of July, whatever comes first. Even if we only have one pre-order, you will still get the shirt, I promise. Yeah, check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. The website is definitely not well optimized for it right now. And if we need to figure some other way of doing the transaction and getting you the shirt, like, we can work with that. So... take a look at that, guys. You know where to find us. We're on Instagram at Not Alone Podcast. We're on Facebook at Not Alone Pod. We're on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. Follow me there. I say all sorts of funny things.
Oh, gosh.
Last night I was talking, or no, this morning I was talking about how when I die, I'm going to haunt Jason.
Surprise.
It's going to be
great. You know what? Yeah. I still won't believe it.
I know you won't. That's what's so frustrating. Cracking open a cold one with the boys. All right.
You and Casper? Coming Casper. On.
You can come to our nice little website, notalonepodcast.com. You can email us, notalonepodcast@gmail.com. You can reach out to us anywhere. I'm going to have Jason say the outro, but first there's a message that we both feel it is...
110%.
110%
something that we should
important to
absolutely talk about, because we both have faced our own demons as well. So Sam?
Yeah. All right. If you're sticking around, thank you for sticking around. Now, as we've discussed in this episode, in our opinion, possession is a real, albeit very rare, phenomena.
Extremely
rare. Neither Jason or I are qualified to give you advice regarding mental illness, but there definitely are those who are. If you find yourself struggling, afraid, or confused by things that you've been experiencing or feeling, we completely and absolutely advocate finding comfort and explanation through the faith that we know so many of our listeners hold dear to them. However, we would also encourage you to seek professional medical help, as well as reaching out to those around you who love you very much. We will be linking to some resources in our show notes, including the National Alliance on Mental Illness and some great steps to help find peer and professional support groups. If you ever find yourself in an emergency, please do not be afraid to call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Personally speaking, I have had to call that number before, and the volunteers on the other end are very wonderful, kind people. If all else fails, 911 is there as well. Please, please, please remember that the world is a beautiful place and there is so much joy to be had. You are so special and so important to us, every single one of you. You are all the greatest fans that anyone could ask for, and we would be devastated to lose even a single one of you. Now, if all else fails, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll do our best to get you the information that you need.
Thank you so much for that, Sam.
Yeah.
Well said. So, remember, whether you're training to expel demons or finding the courage to fight your own, you are
not alone.